Has the milling wheat sector reached a crisis point? Is government really borrowing over £1 billion now? We'll hear from the relevant ministers shortly, as well as the Treasury Minister's generosity in handing out winter and Christmas bonuses and free TV licences for over 75s. Later in the programme, Tynwald likes onshore wind and agrees that the airport and the sea terminal do actually need tidying up. The DOI Minister announces some tinkering with his department's responsibilities too. But first, how is Food Minister Claire Barber MHK getting on with finding solutions for the future of Manx milling wheat?
Obviously, Ramsay Bakery pulled out about 18 months ago, or closed down 18 months ago. How are things progressing with regards to milling wheat?
So, I mean, even prior to Ramsay Bakery closing down, in fact, there had been reports conducted prior to my time looking at the fact that there was this very strong reliance on one business in terms of Laxey Glen Mills. So that was an area they were aware of, and they'd already explored some of the options that might exist. And obviously there is some challenge. Obviously the mill has a board of directors that is more in line with Treasury, I suppose I would say, than it is with DEFA. But obviously from an agricultural policy and food security policy, absolutely, the future of the mill is something that we are engaged in and very passionate about. But certainly, I think the changes we saw with Laxey Glen Mills absolutely inevitably had a significant effect. Ramsay Bakery had a significant effect on Laxey Glen Mill. But we're now seeing, obviously, some shift again in that bakery space. So we know that we have a large number of cake makers and pie makers and so on who use Laxey Glen Mills flour and are very loyal to that brand and know that the quality is there. But we also know we had Noah Bakery and Ross Bakery were the two of a significant size, I suggest, but not on the scale of Ramsay Bakery. Obviously, there's been, again, another shift recently with Robinson's announcing their Ross Bakery purchase and then investing in a new amount of plant machinery in Robinson. So there's some really exciting moves in this space, and what we want to make sure is that our decisions don't pen us into something that doesn't allow that flexibility. So I suppose it's always a bit of a movable picture, and that's why it's so important that within our food security plan we create things that can flex and move depending on what happens, I suppose, out with our control.
And the shocking figures that were revealed during the question and answer session were that we've gone down from a 13,000 ton milling wheat harvest to, I think, is it the coming year, there's going to be just 500 tons contracted from milling wheat growers. Are we going to end up with a situation where you come forward with a really good strategy, but actually the mill and wheat growers have actually packed up and moved on to something else?
And that has certainly been, I think it's fair to say, a concern. But it's not just in supporting those milling wheat growers to supply to the mill. It's also recognising how can we best support those milling wheat growers, perhaps to export. Because part of our food security piece will absolutely be about looking at those areas where we can export, perhaps in the short term, but with a view that should there be a crisis or something that presents a challenge to us, we could bring that supply back locally. But all of that is, as I say, lots of different parts to that. We know that there's been a lot of talk around support for the cost on the steam packet. But equally, we know that it's also right to assess that in the scheme, I suppose, of lots of other areas that are putting pressure around the fares on the steam packet. So it's not just in relation to food. And that's right for us in terms of the current review of sea services agreement that's going to come up in the next couple of years to reflect how best we can use that money across all of government to make sure that we're protecting those things that are most important to us. And for me, I think food security absolutely is up there.
And one of the things that I think growers, bakers and consumers of Manx bread can take at least some encouragement from was your unequivocal support for the need for a milling wheat sector, a bakery on the island in support of Manx food security.
Absolutely, and I think the support around the mill, the dairy and the meat plant go far beyond actually just the simple provision of dairy products, meat and bread, or flour. The reality is actually it's so much bigger because we have a really circular industry in terms of our agricultural positioning, and some of the byproducts that come from those crops then also sustain other producers, and you take one piece out and you don't just lose that sort of food. So if you took the mill out, you don't just lose flour or you don't just lose bread. The reality is if you take the mill out, you lose all of those other benefits, having the bedding straw, having the wheatings, which were used by the pig producers and have obviously significantly decreased. All of those things become part of that cycle. And so actually you take out one piece and you don't just lose that piece. What you lose or what you see is an impact on all the other areas, which is why from an agricultural strategy position, actually I think those three become fundamental parts of where you cross agriculture strategy with our food security strategy, and you can also tie in energy security strategy, and you can tap in our climate change work, biodiversity. It really does just go on and on, and the interconnections I think are just so important, and it's really right that we recognise them.
Chris Thomas had a series of questions in this week's Tynwald about funds and spending. What is he trying to get at?
This week and last week, in fact, basically, we have a huge amount of money now that's being spent without coming back to Tynwald as it used to in the old days, and that's the big picture. Another element of the big picture is what are the priorities? So by asking about the Project Development Fund for capital projects, by asking about Manx Development Corporation, by asking about the Transformation Fund, by asking last week about the Economic Strategy Fund, I'm trying to get all the detail in public about what the real priorities for government are, because follow the money, that's where you can see what matters. And today I suggested that things like highways, housing, the harbour, the airport didn't actually seem to be as prioritised as the onshore wind farm, Castle Rushen High School and Peel Marina.
And are those not worthy projects?
Yeah, of course they are. There are so many things that need investment, but the process that I'm unpicking, and we'll get in public eventually, is the way that things are prioritised. And the suggestion I made at the end is that by the time a list is read out in here, everything's been funded. And before that, you've got Treasury and Council Ministers deciding what the priorities are, not Tynwald, as happened in former times. And also, you've now got Treasury-embedded officers in all of the departments. And I suggested that that's where the real decisions are being made, because it was my experience in Department of Infrastructure that those Treasury-embedded officers and the DOI were saying, there's really no point putting that forward, but this would make a lot of sense. So 1 minute.
And that's extraordinary. You're effectively saying that Treasury has its officers working on all the departments of government.
Yeah, that's true now. There's no denying that. We have financial advisors, which are a centralised shared service inside each of the departments. So in your day, DOI had its own financial officer. Now we have a group of people who are Treasury employees helping us put together our budget bids and our capital budget bids and the like.
And officers telling ministers what their priorities should be.
Well, they're not. They're just helping us make the decisions, and helping the senior officer make decisions, and helping us put forward things into budget bids. But no, the reality is that nothing goes forward into the pinch book until it gets Treasury concurrence, until it goes through the Council of Ministers, and that's the point. It becomes to Tynwald. So on the one hand, we have Charles Garden, Daphne Kane asserting that that there's evil being done taking out the horse tram tracks, and then who's to fault for that? Is it the department or is it somewhere else in the system? So all I'm trying to do is to first of all unpick and expose the real process that's going on through looking at the funds, because today, I'll give you another example, today we learned that I think we're up to nearly 5 million committed from public funds to the Manx Development Corporation, and we heard that there's a quite a large private loan facility that hasn't as yet been drawn down for Manx Development Corporation. So that's a huge amount of money. Last week we heard that there's a 100 million economic strategy fund, 51 million of which has already been committed. Today we learn more about the project development fund and the transformation fund and the sorts of projects that are going to be funded from it. This is a huge change in the way that public finance, it's a huge change in the role of people in this court versus other people around the system. And I do think it's the right time to unpick what's actually going on and make sure we're happy with what's going on. Mr. Speaker was very surprised with one answer that was given, because it was suggested to him that the loan facility for Manx Development Corporation wasn't government debt, and Mr. Speaker had a big problem with that. I'm on Mr. Speaker's side. You know, in the 20th century, often people got in big trouble when they started pretending that money that had been guaranteed or money that was off balance sheet wasn't really the responsibility of the central entity, and it would be a great shame if because I think we're actually up to about £1 billion of debt now from the Isle of Man government, and still people say the Isle of Man government doesn't have any debt. But if we're up to £1 billion in local authority loans, bonds, MUA guaranteed bonds, MDC loan facilities, that's a huge amount of borrowing. £1 billion, you know, that's quite a transformation from the days when you could genuinely say the Isle of Man government didn't have any debt. There is a place for the public sector getting involved in moving the economy forward and helping society address gaps, but we've got to make sure that government isn't gambling, taking too much risks with the public purse. And if we are going to take big risks, at the very least, we've got to get the public's representatives in the House of Keys fully involved and fully informed while it's going on. Otherwise, it's a democratic disaster, never mind financial disaster, potentially written all over it.
Does Treasury Minister Alex Allenson agree with Chris Thomas's suggestion that government borrowing has topped £1 billion?
I haven't had him suggest that to me, but no, it's not correct. What we do each year with the budget is spell out exactly what our revenue and expenditure are and what government borrowing is, and we make that quite clear. Now, obviously, government, there is some borrowing there, in particular in terms of the bond issuance, the sustainability bond, and also there's borrowing on behalf of local authorities, which is underwritten by government. There's also borrowing by statutory boards, which comes through the Consolidated Loan Fund. And some of the discussions today were about the Manx Development Corporation, which is an arm's length body, which has arranged a loaning facility with a commercial bank to actually develop brownfield sites. And all of this is quite strictly regulated and overseen by Treasury, which is our job, but also made quite clear to the public.
Mr. Speaker seemed quite surprised in relation to the loan facility, the borrowing facility that Manx Development Corporation has, in relation to the way in which that's going to be reported. Do you share any of Mr. Speaker's concerns about that?
Well, his question was whether it would be reported as part of the government accounts. And what I suggested was that the Manx Development Corporation, with their annual accounts, will have that borrowing as part of that. I will look and ask officers whether that needs to be included as well with the government accounts. But the whole idea of the Manx Development Corporation was to go out, leverage private investment in some of these large infrastructure schemes that we're proposing, try to bring to life some of the brownfield sites that have blighted, particularly Douglas, for many decades. And so we need that investment, but that will be coming from private sources rather than necessarily from the public purse, but with that correct governance around it and oversight around it.
I mean, you mentioned about correct governance and oversight, and yet the Manx Development Corporation is not going to be subject to freedom of information requests. So whereas I think you can find out what's going on, the Manx public can't, or have I got that wrong?
I think you're incorrect. There have already been freedom of information requests, which have been effectively answered by the Manx Development Corporation, because whilst they are a company and have their own banking facility, they are responsible to Treasury, we are the key shareholder, but also responsible to the Brownfield site steering group as well, which is a combination of various ministers and various officers to try to coordinate this. So actually there have been freedom of information requests from the MDC that have been answered appropriately in terms of their procurement, in terms of their governance, in terms of some of the terms and conditions about things like their borrowing.
So is it the steam packet then that doesn't answer to freedom of information?
As yet, it is. You're quite correct. And that's been one of the questions that the Chief Minister answered in terms of the operational capacity of the steam packet to compete very much in terms of carriage of goods and services backwards and forwards to the island. And they're not subject to freedom of information requests. The MDC don't really have any real competition because they're developing the sites that nobody else will touch. And so it's far less of an issue there. Although obviously when they're going out for tender for various services, there is some confidential information there that it would be quite harmful if it was made public before some of these agreements were made.
And then in relation to the various funds, there were a couple of funds particularly that were mentioned, the Project Development Fund, the Change Fund, Transformation Fund, and one or other of those included a bid to effectively do away with driving licences, is that correct?
No. So at the last budget, what we tried to do in terms of Treasury was simplify some of the processes. Previously, we had an Invest the Save Fund, which was trying to give various departments money so they could work more efficiently. But we also had a Digital Strategy Fund, which was to allow departments to invest to save and work more effectively. So what we did was roll those both into a Transformation Fund, which gives the ability for departments to look at new ways of providing better services for the public. Now, we've been talking for several years about the validity of still having paper discs on your car, which have to be read by police officers, and then make sure that people have actually paid for their driving for the driving vehicle license. In the UK, they've got rid of these and adopted a more automatic system with number plate recognition. And it is, I think, the policy of DOI to look at that and investigate how we could do that a little bit better. One, to cut down on costs. Two, to ensure that everyone's paying their way. And so some money has gone from the Transformation Fund to the DOI to flesh out exactly what that would look like on a much smaller scale on the Isle of Man, because we'd need a separate system to the UK, but also how that could be provided in the right way. And then develop that policy, take that through Tim Wald as a capital scheme, and actually explain it to the Manx public.
And of course, yes, it's vehicle licence, not the driver's licence. And the reason for this, of course, is to save money, because processes that have formerly been done with various stamps and things that at the post office. And there are substantial amounts of money that can be saved from this.
It's not just about saving money, although I completely agree with you that moving away from a paper-based form of licensing it does save money. But also for a long period of time, DOI have been talking about you being able to pay by either quarterly or monthly installments. That's very difficult when you're giving out a bit of paper that has to do you need to replace that every month? Do you need to replace that every year? By having a much more automatic system, you can bring in much easier payment systems as well to it. So again, it's that service to the public as well, I think, that's really important, driving this forward rather than just saving government money.
Does there come a point where actually we have to acknowledge that we can't have in tandem the two separate electronic paper systems, and we need to encourage people to move into the modern electronic world that most of us now live?
I think there are very strong analogies between the problems the post office is facing and the problems the banking sector is facing. And only this week we've seen the announcement of the closure at Castletown of the Barclays branch. I think with more and more people are working online, they're interacting with government online. That's great and it's more efficient, and as you say, it saves money. However, you then have to look at the cost of providing those face-fronting services in the way that they're done at the moment, and it becomes unsustainable. So it is looking at different ways to do that, looking at other partners to do that. I know the post office has been doing that in terms of their retail network. Also, one of the things of their recent annual reports was actually the amount of money that they do make by doing foreign currency. As people are travelling more, that's actually been a big boost to their profits. And this is a service that isn't being provided by the routine banks. So again, they can actually look at their business model and perhaps adapt to ways that some of the commercial sectors on the Isle of Man aren't at the moment.
The orders, though, that you'll be moving in Tynwald refer to the winter bonus. I'm not sure that the Christmas bonus is already there. The winter bonus was paused and that then needed to be brought back in. Roughly how much are people now going to be able to benefit from those amounts, and who's eligible?
Yeah, I mean, what we did last year was bring in a whole range of different payments to help people with the rapid increase in costs of energy and the cost of living. That has settled down now. What we've also been trying to do as a government is enabling people to save energy through energy efficiency schemes, and DEFRA is still running those and promoting those as we get towards the winter. With the reinstatement of the winter bonus, this will pay those eligible £350 in January, so certainly help towards that support. But I wanted to try to present that sort of package, that we've got Christmas bonus, which is only £40, but that's still more than the £10 they offer in the UK. That goes out to a significant large number of people. Also looking at the TV licences, which has been debated by Tynwald many times in the past, and it's extending that for another 12 months just to give people a little bit of certainty as we go into the winter, because obviously that would have run out at the end of this year, and I wanted to make absolutely certain to those over 75s who were involved that this would carry on into next year and they didn't have to worry.
That was Treasury Minister Alex Allenson. Loads more after the break. Laurie Hooper moved that Manx Care's annual report be received by Tynwald. Why were there no targets for Manx Care to stay within budget?
I think it's much better to talk to them about efficient use of resources. So that's saying, whilst you are going to come in on budget, actually we want to make sure the money you're spending is being spent wisely and being spent well. And that's a slightly different context, I think, to Mr. Speaker's concerns, where he was, I think, expecting a line that says you've got to come in on budget. And actually, Manx Care could quite easily come in on budget simply by not treating patients. That isn't, I think, what we are trying to achieve here. In terms of some of the other commentary around the report, it's an interesting problem, because Tynwald can't be too operational. It doesn't make much sense for Tynwald to delve into that level of detail. That's what the committee system is for. But equally, the report has to have enough detail and enough information in to satisfy the expectations, I think, of Tynwald Court. So it's still very much an evolving picture. It's still a learning experience. And I think this year's report is much better than last year's. There's much more data. There's more performance reporting. And I think that will only improve, really, as time goes on.
As far as patients are concerned, do you think that they are beginning to see the fruits of Manx Care's labours, or is it still some distance away, the bright uplands to which we're all supposedly headed in terms of improved healthcare delivery?
So I think it's a mixed picture. I think Manx Care have spent a lot of time getting the quality and the safety metrics right, making sure the services they're providing are safe and are can be delivered safely. It's been a real focus for them over the last 2 years. And I think in some areas we have seen quite big improvements in things like waiting times and waiting lists. You have seen recently Manx Care winning a best in country kind of award for the HIP programme. So there are things which we can say with confidence are much better. There are other areas, I think, where progress is slower, and that tends to be, I think, as one of the members in Tynwald highlighted, in areas that are more difficult to report on. So it's difficult to demonstrate, for example, that the wellbeing partnerships are having a positive impact on emergency attendance at the ED. They inevitably will be, because people are going to the wellbeing partnerships rather than turning up at A&E. But actually measuring that when you're set against a more background level of higher demand is quite difficult. So I think it's probably fair to say that in some areas, yes, there are definite patient-facing improvements that people can see categorically on the ground. Other areas, I think it's slightly slower in coming. But broadly speaking, I think the system is generally improving year on year. It may be slower than some people would ideally like. I think it's slower than I would ideally like. But I think it is definitely getting better.
Realistically, what would you hope that the position will be over the next 12 months?
So I think realistically, more of that incremental improvement is what we're looking for. I think as long as we are seeing continued incremental improvement, things are getting better, then I think that is good news for the island. I think what I would like to be able to report on next year would be a stabilisation of some of our primary care services. So pharmacy services, for example, you know, there's been a big change with Lloyd's Pharmacy and Clear in recent months. I'd like to be able to see a stable, you know, well-stocked, well-functioning primary pharmacy network. I'd like to be able to report on improvements around things like dentistry or primary care in GPs. And I'd very much like to be able to report to Tim Woolcourt on some of the big steps that are being taken by Manx Care in areas of children's mental health, ADHD, autism, some of the big areas that we're trying to develop strategies on right now. So in a perfect world, and not trying to be too unrealistic, I think there are definitely lots of areas where we will be able to come back next year and be quite positive. Obviously, all that's subject to funding and subject to Tim Ward's support, but I really do think that we should be in a good position next year to be able to report positively on a lot of the things that are going on.
The transfer of the health services transformation responsibility from the Cabinet Office to your department. I suppose to start with, people might be puzzled as to why health services transformation was in the Cabinet Office in the first place.
So that was one of the recommendations by Sir Jonathan, and I think the logic behind it was when you were looking to split the department from Manx Care, the department really couldn't do that itself. It needed to be done to the department, and so that made sense to have it sitting centrally. There were also other changes as part of his transformation programme, like moving public health to the Cabinet Office, some of which were more broader government aims rather than simply healthcare. Most of the non-healthcare stuff has now been it's done, and the stuff that needed to be done to the department has also been done. So now predominantly what's left is things which are much more patient-facing, so pathway development, for example, improving the care pathways, figuring out what we do on island versus what we do off island, the stuff that's much more operational. So now it makes a lot of sense to say those things really should fall inside the remit of the Department of Health and Social Care, because strategy and policy and legislation, that's what we do now. So really it makes sense for it to come back over. There's also I think a question around some confusion. Mr. Thomas yesterday referred to an answer he had from the Treasury which talked about the Cabinet Office getting funding for the Manx Care record, and he seemed to be confused as to why the Cabinet Office would be the ones bidding for that. It's because the transformation programme currently sits in Cabinet Office, and I think there's an expectation really amongst members and amongst the public that, well, actually the Health Minister and the Health Service is responsible for the Health Service, and to be honest, that makes a lot of sense.
And indeed, I suppose, in terms of accountability, if you have two ministers that you can point fingers at, together with Manx Care as a third potential area of accountability, it's better if it's limited to one area, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And I think there's also, when we have the transformation programme, because that's a board and it's had three ministers sitting on it, obviously you're not necessarily going to get a perfect alignment with the health service, because if I'm trying to get something done in healthcare, that might be my priority. But if the transformation board votes by majority and says no, something else is a priority, you might end up with the potential disconnect. Luckily, that hasn't happened too much, so we haven't seen too much divergence. But I think you're right, from an accountability perspective, it makes much more sense to say, actually, this is your responsibility, Minister, you should deal with this.
Tim Glover failed to get support for his motion to delay progress on the onshore wind farm at Airy Stain. Is he just standing in the way of progress?
I'm a fan of onshore renewables. I've made that very, very clear. I was quite astonished at times during the debate that people were debating something that wasn't my motion at all. I've never said that we should put our electricity supply in the hands of private companies. That was not the motion at all. It was for the Manx Utilities to work with the private sector on this. And certainly with regard to renewables, it appears that the Isle of Man is closed. And that's the impression that's being given by all of this. So there's been a lot of upset and unrest amongst constituents in Arbury, Castletown and Maloo. And I was representing them. That's my job.
The MUA, of course, does buy electricity in through the interconnector from time to time. Presumably, they can't say that they're only prepared to accept public sector produced electricity, or am I missing something?
Well, they've already said in scrutiny committees that they can't do this all on their own. And even if the wind farm does go ahead with the four or five turbines at Airy Stain and Skirt, that's not going to be enough for them anyway. They're going to have to find other resources anyway. They're also at some point going to have to find resource to update the grid and renew and strengthen that. That's a lot of money that we're looking at here, and I cannot see with the way we're spending reserves already at the moment, just to sort of maintain the status quo, as it were, that we're going to be able to afford this without going in partnership with private enterprise as well. Otherwise, we'd crash the economy. We don't want that. Generational debt for years.
The MUA will reasonably argue that they have a lot of good, highly experienced professional people working for them, and suggestions that in some way the scheme is rushed, bearing in mind it's taken years, decades even to get even to this stage, and also your suggestion that this was in some way akin to the Liverpool landing stage. These are just throwaway remarks to try and support a few residents who don't like the idea of a wind farm, aren't they?
Well, no. Let's look at what the Public Accounts Committee came back with. And they said there'd been a rushed, insufficient planning, that had been rushed. And
this is specifically Liverpool.
Liverpool, so. and the budget was just... Well, it was pie in the sky, basically, or in the sea in this case. I can see the comparisons here. The MUA have been given a target date of 2026 to be able to deliver 20 megawatts of onshore renewable energy. That's an incredibly tight time frame when you've got to go through all the surveys and the planning process as well. So that really is ringing alarm bells for me, that let's not just... there's already a considerable sum of money already been put up for this scheme, and I don't want us to be repeating what we saw at Liverpool, because we cannot afford to make that mistake again. We've got to learn the lessons.
And another site has apparently been announced, the Roundtable site. Was that in the original consideration of sites? I mean, there were 500-odd sites that were mentioned. Three reached the top of the list. One was ruled out because it was inaccessible. I think that was in Ingebrek. Another one has been not ruled out, but not the ideal site, which is around the Sulby Reservoir area, and then the Skerd site. So where's this additional site come from?
Yeah, Roundtable suddenly popped up with Mrs. Kane remarking on that. But I've looked at the map. As far as I can see, that is Heathland and Peatland and would be a no-go area. So I don't know where that suddenly appeared from.
And I suppose then, in relation to your motion, it was roundly defeated. It's fair to say nobody in Legislative Council felt it was worthy of support. Everyone feels, everyone apart from four MHKs, including yourself, felt that this was just a time-delaying tactic. And quite frankly, they felt it was... just wasn't worth the time that was spent debating it. This is just about protecting the interests of a few of your constituents, isn't it?
It was 2 hours of debate in there, so if they were thinking that was a waste of time, many of them wanted to speak on it, so I'd argue and contend that it wasn't a waste of time whatsoever. I think Mr. Crookle, the outgoing chair of Manx Utilities, hit the nail on the head when he said this debate was going to happen at some time, and he thanked me for bringing it to him. So, you know, it's more the reason I brought it is it is not just about the residents in the immediate area. This is a national issue. That's why I brought it to Tymwell Court and brought it to the attention. And it's had 2 hours of debate. Yes, it was beaten, but 2 hours of debate on a really, really important national topic.
And having heard the now former chair of the MUA saying that this needed to come to Tynwald for debate, are you surprised that the MUA didn't choose to bring it for debate themselves?
Yes, is the short answer on that. I think some of those that voted against this did remark that the communication and the way this has been handled from the very beginning has not been the best. So I would agree with that.
Jason Moorhouse was successful in gaining Tynwald support for his motion, which lamented the poor state of the airport and sea terminal.
And basically, it would appear, anyway, that you're concerned that people getting off the plane or getting off the boat don't have the best of introductions to the Isle of Man.
That's it. And the motion went well from the point of view that everyone spoke positively about the island, and the affection, the recognition of how special we are came through with all the speeches. But there was that underlying concern that we can do things better. And it's not doing things radically different. It's just ensuring that the things that should be done are done.
And why is it? I mean, I drove past the airport myself a few days ago, and an attempt had been made to trim some bushes, and the trimmed bush, the big lump of it, was just lying on the pavement next to the trimming. Surely to goodness, it can't be that difficult to get something like this right.
It does seem challenging, and more challenging than one would assume. It's something I've raised before. I've spoken to infrastructure ministers about it. I've talked to the workers who are doing this, and I do recognise on the ground there are challenges, that when the gardens were magnificent and beautiful, there's a whole team of gardeners. Now we're down to one man who's pushing like mad to achieve what he can achieve. So things have changed, but there are, you know, the more basic things like at the sea terminal, just in terms of the general cleanliness of the area. It's now brought up twice in the past 2 years, and it's still not where it should be. And just things like that just give the wrong image. You know, it's a small, minor thing, but for someone who's getting that last impression, it's going to be the bit that really does drag us down slightly.
And the encouraging news is the Enterprise Minister is going to set up a committee to investigate the matter.
Yeah, and having spoken to the Visits Alaman agency, there's the desire to do something that's got support. And I think they were concerned that this was the direction they wanted to move in. But in terms of getting the recognition and the interest in this, there was kind of the potential for a void. And hopefully this debate has filled that and given them the reassurance that we want them to do this and we want them to do this well.
One humorous comment in the debate was that perhaps Mr. Moorhouse would like to join this committee when it's established.
Yeah, that would be an interesting one. But, you know, there are going to be lots of other good candidates. And whether I'm on the committee or just watching from outside, I really do hope that the committee can do good things, because we're in a special place and it's just refining things rather than doing things radically different.
And, of course, what almost everybody, well, certainly everyone who spoke in Tynwald said about the island is it's a most fantastic, beautiful place. And, it's a shame that a few little things can let it down.
That's it. That was an underlying concern, but also the realisation that those concerns could actually be resolved. I think Minister Lord Brennan's point about, you know, this can be done, it should be done, there are ministers responsible for this, departments can do this, and it was that simple. This can be done and it needs to be done.
As ever, you had a string of questions for various ministers. But most importantly, I think you had a question down to the chair of the Office of Fair Trading in relation to the situation with, we're not allowed to call it, they're not Manx Gas now, but Isle of Man Energy.
Yeah, it's a concern that I've really had for the last 10 days. I realised last Monday evening that two of my constituents had their gas turned off. And I put a post on Facebook just to find out, was this happening elsewhere? And within moments, another 12 people came on to me. And last Tuesday, I contacted the OFT and the Chief Minister saying, can this programme be paused? Something's gone wrong here.
But there was a reasonable result in relation to the answer that the chair of the OFT gave, in that a joint statement had been made between Isle of Man Energy and the OFT.
Yeah, I was really pleased with the statement. Given the hiccup we had last week and the continuation of the programme and the people actually suffering from this, it was good to actually have this update. I spoke to Mr. Wannenberg several times last week and several times yesterday about what was happening, and he did push it as far as he could. You know, I was pleased with what he came out with. It was really what I was asking for. So, yeah, it gives people a breathing space, but it is really important that those people who do owe money look for solutions, because it's soon going to be next year. It's soon going to be that time when they've got to make the payments. And if the payments haven't been made as a commercial company, there are going to be real issues to deal with. So I really do implore people, pay what you can. If you're stuck at the moment, talk to the OFT, talk to your MHK and try and find a solution.
Another area and part of the solution potentially could be a winter bonus and a Christmas bonus. And you were quizzing the Treasury Minister in relation to this. Primarily, I think, you seemed concerned that Tynwald members didn't seem to get much by way of prior information about this announcement.
Yeah, that was a definite concern that the programme had been reactivated. We'd had continuation of the television license programme, and it was slightly disappointing that we kind of read it in a news release. But as a good thing, that winter programme is going to help many people. The problem is, it's going to arrive after Christmas, and people are really struggling over the next few days, next few weeks, and it would have been good if it could have been brought forward. But I listened carefully what the minister said, and you know, this has been thought about, and it's actually good to have that programme reactivated.
Part of that, though, was extension for a further year of the free TV licences for over 75s. Now, obviously, that's a very popular thing, but it's going to cost, I think the minister suggested, £800,000. And, you know, we don't appear to have £800,000 to spend on such things. And, you know, the people on income support, fair enough, they would get support for their TV licence, but we're talking about many people who have plenty of money to be able to afford to pay this. Is this really a key priority for government?
I think there was a definite concern. It's a question I've actually raised previously, and the minister did confirm it was something he was looking at, and we got the announcement on the 2nd of November. But as you suggest, that there are many other priorities. There are many groups out there who are actually struggling to put food on the table, and this does look questionable. And with the question, actually went beyond those known groups, those groups that get the assistance. And there are many people out there with mortgages and other commitments, and they are really struggling at the moment. So, you know, I did push the envelope and say, you know, before the budget, can these concerns, these considerations really be taken into account, please?
A couple of other, well, I mean, there were several other questions that you had, but one specifically that I was interested in was this apparent power for the Health and Social Care Department, and indeed Manx Care, I suppose, to transfer adults who don't have capacity to off-island care.
Yeah, it was a very interesting question, and the answers were even more interesting, and it did seem to emerge that Manx Care are doing this with the best of intentions, but if it actually comes down to a legal challenge, it could be very difficult for them to actually justify what they're doing and to move that forward. So I think people who are in that position are going to have a little bit of reassurance this afternoon.
Although, obviously, it costs a lot of money regardless, wherever you have people who need this sort of intense level of care. Do you think that it's going to be possible to look after patients' needs on the Isle of Man in the way that perhaps specialist units in the United Kingdom or further afield could do?
Your suggestion is a strong one, and in terms of the case I'm aware of, they have been looked after on island, and the families did hope that that care would continue here in the future. So there is a possibility it can be done, but as you also suggest, there's a high cost, and Manx Care look at every penny they spend and trying to get the best outcome for their patients. So we'll see what happens. But it was reassuring the minister didn't dismiss it as a possibility. And yeah, it's going to be looked at, and I think those people in this situation are going to feel slightly more reassured this afternoon that they can do something.
And finally, you had the question about the post office. What's your concern there?
I've got a massive concern that at least 19 people who had redundancy letters, all 19 could lose the jobs. There's a possibility that 7 will hold on to the jobs. With all the correspondence to my previous questions, it all comes down to the shift in the mail from coming from by air to actually coming by sea. And there's something actually more serious within the post office than they're actually allowing us to hear about at the moment. I've been told on several occasions about contracts being lost and things. And despite trying to push that, the chairman is just giving no additional information. And from what I've been hearing there, share the parcels market has just crumbled. And that's the actual cause of the possible redundancies and the concern. And I do hope that when Mr. Peters gets his next chance to come up with a clear answer, he does it, because at the moment it's starting to appear a bit like the final page of Animal Farm.
Minister Crookle made a statement on reform of the DOI, but his announcement only really touched on relatively minor aspects of the DOI.
They are, but it's a start, and you know, this has been going on for a while, as I made comment and misstatements. You know, going back to Minister Thomas's time, you know, he probably instigated this. I made some comments when I first went in there in 2021, but Chris picked it up, and then the chief obviously instigated it when he took over during the interim during the summer. But it's work that needs doing. That, you know, you were there yourself as well, Phil. The department is huge at the moment, and we just need to sort of have a look at it, see what it needs to be doing and what it doesn't need to be doing, and then try and make some changes.
And of course, the scale in terms of numbers of people and budgets are not necessarily the issue. It's the fact that you, as minister, have a whole raft of policy areas that you have to keep your head around.
Yeah, but it's everything that we do is in the public domain, and like some of the other departments as well, but everything we do is in the public domain, and, you know, we're not coping. We haven't coped well, and, you know, going back from your time, we're probably half the workforce there now that we had, and the budget's been cut as well. So we need to make the best of what we've got and make it work for the island.
In relation then to the potential for transferring functions out of the department, one seemed to be a fairly obvious one, which was moving out Port Security and Coast Guard to Home Affairs so that all the blue light services would be together. The other was moving the local government unit to the Cabinet Office. And then finally, there was talk of shifting the minibus service back to all the individual departments. Are all of these achievable? Is it going to result in an improved service, or is this just about reducing the political workload of the department so that you can get your, you know, you can be better informed and better in charge of the areas that need your attention?
It's certainly not about the political workload, but it's about delivering a better delivery service, and certainly with the minibus services between that we give to Desk and to Manx Care at the moment, you know, it's been tried over the years, and it's actually been proved now that actually, you know, they keep telling us what they want, we try and deliver it, but they know exactly what they want, so it should go back to them, you know, and they can deliver it as well then. You know, we'll give them the minibuses back and things, and they can deliver their own service. It's been tried, it hasn't worked as well as it could have done. It's been good, nobody says it's been bad, but it could be a lot better. And it's time to give it back to them as far as we're concerned, if we can make it work. But obviously, when it came, there was a budget with it, as I said in my statement, and that budget has now gone up probably threefold in some respects, which comes out of the DOI budget, and we'll have to look at how we work that out. But, you know, if we're going to make it happen, we'll just have to say, OK, we'll cut our losses here, have it back, and then, you know, we'll work away from that then.
Local government, of course, as I think former Minister Chris Thomas pointed out, includes areas like waste management, includes highways functions that were transferred to the local authorities. I mean, these are areas that your department remains responsible for. How does moving that out to the Cabinet Office help?
Well, Chris picked on those, and quite rightly they are in the department, whether it's actually those that go or not, or whether it's just certain parts of it. But, you know, obviously the roads belong to us and it's better off. And I actually think that may well be that, you know, some of the local authorities want to do the road work, some of them don't, and it's actually a mess. And when it comes to down, who's responsible for that? Is it local authorities? Is it Highway Board? You know, so I think we need to sort of look that out and just look at that and just say, okay, we take it back, or everybody does their own little bit. And I don't think they will do so. It could well be that we end up taking them back. But those discussions, everything's up for discussion at the moment. And I'm going to the municipal meeting at the end of the month, and we'll start those discussions. But we will go in and talk to the local authorities as soon as possible.
And finally, back to the Treasury Minister. David Ashford asked you about what support is available specifically in relation to people whose energy supplies have been terminated. You must be quite concerned to discover that energy companies are cutting supplies to people who probably are in many cases the most vulnerable in society.
Yes, I mean, what we had at November Tynwald was a raft of questions and statements made about the announcement from Alaman Energy, formerly known as Manx Gas, that after, I think, about 2 years of not cutting people off post-COVID, they've started sending letters threatening disconnection. And that's worried a lot of members of our community. And as you say, a lot of those people who are very low income or perhaps seen as vulnerable because they've got medical problems, they're elderly, they've got young children, or they've got young children with disabilities. We've responded by being quite strict and quite firm with the company. And actually, I met with them, with the Chief Minister, who asked some very searching questions with them and really trying to get some commitments from them to actually look after their customers, to actually monitor the consequences of their actions. But we are working with the company. I know the Office of Fair Trading have made several statements today and issued a press statement in combination with them in terms of, you know, trying to gauge what the actual impact of these threats of disconnection are, but also work with the company to make sure that people are listened to, that people's needs are met. And one of the take-home messages, I think, from all of the questions today is if people are struggling to pay their bills, please reach out to the supplier, whether that be your gas supplier or your electricity supplier or even your oil supplier. A lot of them now have payment plans. A lot of them can balance the payments over a period of time. And if you are struggling in terms of benefits, reach out to Social Security as well, because we can signpost you to a whole range of different organisations that can help, both in terms of budgeting, loans or grants.
So there you have it. Winter bonuses, milling week woes, when is £1 billion debt not £1 billion debt, and much more. Lots to ponder on this week's show. So what do you think? Are you concerned that government continues to spend lots of the taxes that you pay? Is government closed for business when it comes to onshore renewables? Was outgoing chair of OFT John Wannenberg right in calling out Isle of Man Energy for no conscience, no compassion and having contempt for their customers? For now though, I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayu Sungeishakrom. Thanks for listening.